We're all good. We're all good.
Good.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm glad that now that I can see you, I'm glad to see you. So I'm going to get right into this because this is, okay, I have 35 slides in 60 minutes, 55 now. So I'm just going to rip through this as, at the best speed I can, and hopefully we'll have time for a little questions. If I say anything or anything comes up and you want to know more about it, don't wait till the end. I have my own timer, so we can make use of that. So the big snit, as we called it. I'm just going to set a little stage for you. This is Paris, actually, in 1996, where I was attending the 5th International World Wide Web Conference. Something that I had managed by writing and submitting a paper on the theory that if I did that, then the then Vice President of Case Western, Vice President of Information Technology for Case Western Reserve University, Ray Neff, would send me to Paris on the university's dime, and it worked because Ray was that kind of a guy. I'm not going to get into Ray's stories, but anyway, we could be here all day. So this is where the conference was being held. And this was something that they had on a table. This was the first web server ever. This is the next cube on which Tim Berners-Lee developed his World Wide Web application, as it was then. They apparently had to dig it out of a closet. If you look closely, it's rather dusty. Lord only knows where it is now. Anyway, so there's Tim on the right. And Robert on the left. Anyone know who Robert is? Who would be appearing with Tim? Any guesses? Robert? Yeah, Robert's the other guy who invented the World Wide Web. But he's not a knight of England or any of that stuff now. So Robert Caillou, who was working at CERN, and in 1988-1989 time frame, he was one of two people who proposed a hypertext information access system for CERN and for the internet in general, in order to share physical information. The other person, of course, Tim Berners-Lee. I recently corresponded with Robert, and his contention is that the World Wide Web, as it stands, is mostly Tim's work and only a little bit his. But he does get the co-invention credit since Robert's proposal and Tim's proposals work fine. At least to some extent, in order to create the World Wide Web. Now, I bring all this up for a reason. Robert is a synesthetic. And when I see at least one nodding head, someone who has an idea of what a synesthetic is. For those who don't know, someone who is synesthetic is someone who has sensory effects basically crosswired. So as an example, one of the rarer types of synesthesia is feeling something tactile when hearing a sound. It's been shown that actually these people tend to develop perfect pitch because they know the correct feeling for a pure A or whatever. Robert here has one of the more common types of synesthesia, which is he's a letter color synesthetic. If you show him this graphic with the black letters, this is what it looks like to him. Okay. Synesthesia is, I find, endlessly fascinating, especially like this. Apparently, for the vast majority of synesthetics, who are letter color synesthetics, print in languages they don't understand is not colored. But if they start to learn the language, then the letters start to color in. Robert says that it actually helped him a great deal with editing papers. Because if a word is misspelled, he can tell from the color combination. Robert is also the reason why the original WWW logo, which you can see in these five conference logos, was green. Because for Robert, the letter W is green. And to have W be any color other than that or black actually looks wrong to him. So that's where that came from, if you've ever wondered why they had those green logos. Okay, now, I told you that story to tell you this one. While I was at this conference, I met Chris Lilly, who would fit right in at this conference, as you can tell. He was carrying a paper presentation and also was about to become the chair of the CSS Working Group. 2 years previously to this, remember this was in 1996, he had said this on the WWW HTML mailing list, saying basically, we need style sheets. He wasn't the only person saying that at the time, but I find this interesting that in late May of 1994, he was saying, look, the web needs style sheets or something like that, because otherwise we're going to end up with a balkanized web. This page looks best when viewed in, you know, browser, whatever. Which we had a period where those badges were all over the web. This page best viewed in Internet Explorer. This page best viewed in Netscape Navigator. At one point, I thought seriously about putting up a badge that said this page best viewed on my computer. You know, because that's what was really, in a sense, that's what those badges say. So, you know, back in the early 90s, people were already saying, hey, look, we need style sheets. Okay, so at the same conference, there was a CSS panel. We're back to 96 now. So this is a little blurry, I admit. It's the only picture I have. I was shooting without a flash. But just very quickly, here's who was on this panel. This is, remember, May of 1996. Chris Wilson from Microsoft, Dave Raggett, then of the W3C, now I believe at Hewlett Packard, the guy who invented table markup, not table markup as used for layout, but actual table markup. Dave is the one who said, hey, we need data tables, so here's how we could do that. Hocum Lee, then of the W3C, now Chief Technical Officer of Opera. One of the two people who is referred to as the creator of CSS. And the other one, Bert Boss, then of the W3C, and now of the W3C. Never really left. So this was the panel. Oh, and Martin Durst of the W3C was also in the audience. Martin's a fascinating guy. He speaks more languages than I can even remember the number of. Currently living in Japan. So these guys were up on stage talking about this technology I'd never heard of before called CSS. And they did this demo, Chris did actually, using early build of Internet Explorer 3. Anyone remember that? Where he showed text styling that was just so far beyond anything that was possible at the time on the web. And it just completely blew me away. You can't really tell from the notes that I took in my little spiral-bound notebook, but I just spent the whole time pretty much with my jaw in my lap going, yes, this is what we need. You know, because by 1996, that being the time of the conference, tables and font tags and spacer GIFs and all that stuff was already overrunning the web. And we were resisting it at Case, but you know, it was coming to a point where, you know, either we were going to have our page look like, you know, so 2 years ago, or we were going to have to start doing this stuff. So CSS, yeah, this is what we want. This is going to be awesome. Of course, then I came back home and discovered that browsers weren't the greatest. So as a result, well, basically, I mean, what happened was at the time there was one browser, Internet Explorer 3. It was the only one that had any CSS support. And anyone who's worked with CSS in Internet Explorer 3 knows just how bad it was. But of course, at the time, there was nothing else. So I started, you know, I went home and looked at the specification and started doing stuff, and it started not working the way I thought it was supposed to. So I started creating test pages, just sort of, you know, CSS doesn't have that many properties in it. It can't be that hard to create a test suite. Why don't I just do that? So I did. Eventually, that became the official CSS1 test suite. Probably 80 to 90% of the W3C's CSS1 test suite came from those test pages. That only happened, though, because I actually emailed Chris Lilly, you know, who I'd met in Paris, who I knew was chair of the working group, said, hey, I have these test pages. Maybe that would be of interest. And he actually said, wow, can I share these with Microsoft and Netscape? And I was like, yeah, sure. So it was interesting then getting mail from browser engineers telling me my tests were wrong and then arguing with them in some cases. I remember one, I won't say which company he worked for, but one of the engineers argued with me for several email volleys over what a PICO was. It turned out that he thought that there were 144 times as many PICOs in a given inch as there actually are. He like divided, multiplied instead of divided or whatever. So, fortunately, that was before that particular version of that browser got released. Anyway, because I had because I had these test pages, I thought, well, hey, let's put together some charter. At this stage, as I say, there was Internet Explorer 3 for Windows, actually, and it was the only one that had CSS support. And then IE3 for Mac came out right around the same time, and it had some CSS support. But I wanted to know what was working and what wasn't. And there was only one page of information on the entire web, at least that I could find, regarding CSS support in browsers, and that was for IE3 for Windows. Well, it's been a long time since I used a computer that didn't have an Apple on it. This was definitely after that switch happened. So, you know, I wanted support information for IE3 for Mac. There wasn't any, so I created it myself, basically, and threw it out there on the web, you know, for free. Just as Braden McDaniel had done with his IE3 for Windows page. And that, I mean, that's, of course, how it was at the time. I should say, however, that I was lucky because when I was testing support for this stuff, support was pretty binary. Either it was supported, or it wasn't, or it was badly broken. Either way, there was very little subtlety about it. Not like today, where you would say, where a support chart might say supported, but then there would be 16 footnotes, and then they would list all the exceptions to, you know, the support of margin, which in some browsers margin isn't supported on form elements. At the time, you know, there were no such sort of fine distinction. It was either this works or this doesn't. Anyway, those were the IE3 days. This is the beginning of the support chart for Internet Explorer 3. You can see, you know, bug. Okay, we have some support, but then there's a bug in sans serif font family specific, you know, whatever. That's how you treat the Mac. But then, come on. There we go. Salvation! Arrived! Or not. It was comparative salvation. Really. Netscape 4 looked good when it came out as compared to IE3. Now, anyone who's been doing web design or knows anything about CSS knows how long we cursed this browser. But at the time, it was so much better than IE3. In fact, it's amazing to me when I look back at some of my old files regarding CSS support in IE3, it's amazing to me that anyone ever bothered to try CSS stuff. There's just so little that's supported. I mean, even if you're charitable, it's like a 13% support of CSS1. So, but Netscape 4 came out, and it had its quirk, like thinking that there's space between a border and the padding of an element. That's better. And other kinds of weird stuff. But this meant that there was now a need to actually start support in other, right, in more than one browser. So you would have Netscape 4, IE3, IE4. You can see IE4, at least here in the beginning, fares pretty well as compared to IE3 or even Netscape 4. So this was 1997 we've gotten up to. This is also fun. If you look closely, I know you can't read this out there, but you can at least see the colors. This column is IE4 for Windows, and this column is IE4 for the Mac. Now you'll notice that they're inconsistent with each other because the two have never been the same code base. But not only have they never been the same code base, but at least at this stage, the two teams didn't really talk to each other. So the link element was supported, yes, here in IE4 for Windows, but not IE4 for Mac. And, well, it has a bug in IE4 for the Mac. And then add import, supported in IE4 for Windows, not in IE4 for the Mac. I mean, you know, just stuff like that was, you know, quite properly driving authors up a wall. Anyone here probably using CSS during this time frame? Anyone? Okay, guess not. So, I'm trying to think of a good analog. Unfortunately, I can't. Something like, you know, suppose there were two major Python interpreters that people used, and they were wildly inconsistent about what they did when you actually ran your Python program. You know, no one should put up with that. And to a certain extent, the only reason we did is that, you know, there was really not any other choice. If there were that situation with Python, then people would just not use Python, right? They'd be like, look, I can't deal with the inconsistency. I'm going to use a language that actually works. Well, we didn't exactly have another web that we could all go to that was more consistent. So this is what we were stuck with. Here's what changed things. The Web Standards Project. It was right around that same time, the 1997-98 time frame, when a number of people, not these people exactly, but Jeffrey Zeldman, Glenn Davis, and a few others who were web designers at the time were sort of reacting to this inconsistency between browsers. You know, the analogy they used at the time was if television programs that had to be developed differently for different TVs, then television never would have gotten anywhere. This is crazy that we're spending all of our time, well, half of our time developing sites and then half of our time redeveloping the site for another browser than the one we developed in. What we really need here is we need standards. We need some consistency. I mean, that only makes sense, right? Of course, at the time, everyone said that it wasn't going to happen and it couldn't be done and browsers would never be consistent and these guys were just wasting their time and making a lot of noise, self-promoting, and blah, 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 whatever. They formed the Web Standards Project and formed some action committees. One of them is the CSS Action Committee, which dubbed itself the CSS Samurai because when it started out, there were seven. Yes, I know there are 10 names on this list. A few got added, but when it started out, there were seven members of the CSS Action Committee. So far as I know, this is the only action committee that ever actually did anything at the WASP. If the others did, they never told anyone else about it. Basically, I think there were two key things that happened in order for the WASP to succeed. Well, okay, two and a half. The first one was kind of a combined strategy. It was, okay, so Jeffrey Zeldman and Glenn Davis and a couple of other guys were on a mailing list and said there ought to be like a web standard group. Okay. But nobody knew who these guys were. Jeffrey Zeldman was not a known name at the time, for example. He had some recognition in the design community, but not, for example, in the web design community. Similarly with Glenn Davis, he wasn't really known as a programmer guy, a project tool, sure, but So what they did is they got people like Tim Bray to be on their steering committee. Tim Bray, who basically Mr. XML. Jeffrey Veen, who had written the Hotwired Style Guide and actually was a fairly well-known name in terms of the web. So they got people like that on their steering committee, and then they basically roadblocked the web. In television advertising, back in the days when there were only free networks, what advertisers would do sometimes is they would purchase roadblocks. They would run the same ad on all three networks at the same time. So no matter what channel you were on, you were going to get the ad. That was what they called a roadblock. So that might be the ad right before the 6 o'clock news, or right after the 6 o'clock news, or whatever. So they basically did the same thing. They got enough people involved that when the Web Standards Project launched, you could not go to a web development community or mailing list basically without hearing about it. They got on CNET and on all kinds of stuff. So that was number one. And the reason that I put those together is because the steering committee members helped make that happen. When Jeff Dean was talking about, you know, this, Tim Bray mentioned it, and Glenn Davis put it on Project Cool, and Jeffrey Zeldman put it on his website, and Wired covered it, and so on and so on. It made a big, big splash. The other thing was what the CSS working group did, Action Committee. We did a number of things behind the scenes, but this is what we did that actually made a difference. Standards compliance reviews. The first of which was Microsoft Windows Internet Explorer's top 10 CSS problems. Okay. So rather than trying to produce this exhaustive document of everything they had done wrong, or everything that they hadn't implemented that needed to be implemented, we just said, okay, these are the top 10 things that we're facing. These are the top 10 things that if they were fixed would make life much better. So then we did the same thing with Opera, and the same thing, again, with Macintosh Internet Explorer. Said, okay, we've looked at it, and this fundamental problem causes all these other problems, so fixing it would be in its best interest. It's interesting to look at this because this text down here says, no, we do not plan on reviewing any Netscape browsers until Communicator 5.0 begins to approach its final form. Of course, there never was a Communicator 5.0. They went straight to 6. And we never really touched Netscape 4 or 4.5 because at the time, Netscape was saying, well, we're going to come out with 5.0 and it's going to be better. We're like, well, okay, they know what's broken in 4. We couldn't even produce a top 10. It would have to be a top 20 at a minimum. Okay. So, and as it says, of about 40 pages in our first two reviews, that was the test pages that we created for the Windows Internet Explorer and Opera CSS problems. Of our first of 40 test pages, there are only 2 that don't demonstrate bugs in Netscape Communicator, and we weren't even looking for bugs when we wrote those tests in Netscape Communicator. So, it was one of those, look, that we're not going to waste anyone's time with that one. So, but the reason why I think these were important is that what they did was they basically said to browser manufacturers, look, we understand that you can't fix everything. So given that you can only fix something, please fix these. Right. This is what's making these are the things that are making developers' lives the most hellish. Support charts, those are nice too. Because the other thing about having up support charts, like the CSS browser support charts that I showed a few slides ago, is that it's sort of an impartial public shaming. You're basically saying, okay, here's what these browsers do, and here's what they don't do. And here's what they do wrong. Here's what they try to do, but they get wrong, so you need to watch out for that even more. And, rather than being this is why I hate Microsoft Internet Explorer, or this is why Opera sucks, or whatever, it was, this is what these guys are doing. And if it's not as nice as we would like it to be, that's not, our fault. there were a couple of times where actually people on the IE team called me to say, hey, about your support chart. And I would go, yeah. And they would say, could you be harder on us, please? Because we need to convince management that this is, that we need to do something here. This is where I really started to learn that in any organization, Microsoft being no exception, usually the people in the trenches want to do the right thing. It's the people above them that are the problem. And it's not that the people above them are inherently evil necessarily, although, maybe they are. I can't speak to their personal lives, but they have very different priorities. A manager does not care, whether it's at Microsoft or Netscape of the time, whatever. The manager doesn't care about following industry standards, except to the extent that it affects the bottom line effect. So the higher ups at Microsoft didn't, if the engineers were to go to them and say, hey, our CSS support's kind of bad, we need to improve it. They don't care, right? The only thing they care about is, do we look better than our competitors? And therefore, are we going to be more successful than our competitors? And so to have a support chart that says, okay, here you go. Here are all these browsers that claim to support CSS. Here's how well or ill they do. And when you break them down to percentages, this browser's on top and these browsers are behind in this order. And if the guys at, the Microsoft managers can be shown that list that says, we're in fourth place, then, that's our best showing. That will get results. That's something that you can use on managed. The engineers typically don't need to be convinced. They would rather, all things being equal, produce a product that does everything it tries to do perfectly, because that means they've done a good job, right? I mean, that's what I like to do when I do jobs. I like to have it come out exactly the way it should and not have any bugs or other problems. So, of course, without a test suite of some fashion or another, the support charts couldn't have been created. Without test pages, which you can think of as a test suite, we couldn't have written these top 10s. Okay? So, I think what that taught me is that in any developing technology, test suites they're critical. You can't get anywhere without them, really. Or you can't get anywhere useful without them. So anyway, moving forward. IE5 came out! Salvation! Or not. It was better than Netscape 4. But, again, it only looked good by comparison. If we look back now, there's a whole raft of things that were just so bad about IE5. For example, it basically didn't support the styling of inline elements. You couldn't apply padding or borders or any of that stuff to inline elements. So hyperlinks, for example, you couldn't really style. And images, you could only sort of style. And that doesn't even get into the various bugs and such that were in IE5. It was better, but still not all that great. Now, remember, we're up to 1999 here. CSS1 came out in December of 1996. This is 3 years down the road. CSS2 came out in May of 1998. This is a year and a half down the road from that. And even in terms of CSS1 support, like I say, it was better, but still wasn't great. What got interesting, though, is that it was better enough that people wanted to do what it could do that older browsers couldn't, right? There was something Netscape 4 just could not handle that IE5 could. And that's where the first CSS hack came from. And it looked like this. Link to a basic style sheet, and then import an advanced style sheet, because Netscape 4 didn't understand at import. Now, this looks more like a markup hack, but it's really a CSS hack because you're using add import as a filter between advanced browsers and non-advanced browsers of the time. If only it had stopped there. And even that was, that was fairly, that could be fairly difficult to manage, because if you put enough stuff in your advanced style sheet, then the basic style sheet had so little styling to it that it was almost like you didn't need to bother. Now, at the time, there was a big argument as to whether or not you should do this or if you should use JavaScript, the browser extension, and then just hand over the style sheet based on which browser your browser detector came up with. And that was where we were, all first introduced to people who hacked their user agent string. So that instead of saying, Microsoft Internet Explorer, blah, 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 it would say, you don't need to know, get out of my cache file, or whatever. I've seen these things in my own server logs. I'm sure you have too. People leaving little jokes for people who read their web server access logs. And also, there was the forward-looking argument of, well, you never know what a future browser will do, and Internet Explorer, no one said this from Internet Explorer because it was from Microsoft. But the next version of Netscape could be perfect with CSS, and then you'd be handing over the wrong style sheet, and et cetera, et cetera. In the midst of all this, actual salvation, as it were. Internet Explorer for the Mac, now 5.0 for the Mac is really the one that I want to have up here, but I couldn't find the splash screen for 5.0. So I grabbed this one. When IE5 for the Mac came out, it was really nothing short of revolutionary in a lot of ways, but in the CSS realm in particular. Here are the things that it added. Just some of the things that it added. Doctype switching. There wouldn't probably be doctype switching today if not for two people, Todd Farner and Tantek Chellin. Todd Farner, in this same time frame, said either on Usenet or a mailing list, I haven't been able to track down the original reference, we have this problem here, right? We have these browsers that are doing stuff wrong. Todd Farner, by the way, anyone recognize that name? Todd Farner? Yeah, good. Okay. At least some recognition. He's making bikes now, so they're a clever temp bike. If you're a biker, you might have actually heard of those. Anyway, he was a designer. He worked with David Siegel, actually, in the same agency. And he was in the CSS at the beginning and wrote a lot of really stunningly intelligent things about font sizing and, all the same stuff that we're worrying about today. Some of the most cogent observations about that were made by Todd back in the late 90s. But he had looked at the browser landscape and said, okay, we have these old browsers that are doing wrong stuff. Internet Explorer for Windows has the box model wrong, right? And font sizing is messed up because Internet Explorer thinks that the default is small and Netscape thinks the default is medium, which is what the specification says. But if you start to dig into it, what Internet Explorer does actually makes some sense anyway. And browsers are stuck on this path, right? What we need is we need some kind of out. We need a toggle where authors could say, no, really, do it the standards way instead of the old way. And wouldn't that be cool if they could just do it in the document? And hey, maybe the doc type would work because the doc type theoretically should be part of documents, but it never is. So maybe if authors said that they're really using it HTML 4.0 strict, then that would be used as sort of a switch to go into standards mode. Todd thinking out loud. So Tantek did it in IE for the Mac. IE 5 for the Mac. There was also a display resolution setting. If you dug far enough into the preferences, there's actually a dialog that says, go get a ruler. Here's a ruler on the screen. Hold the ruler up to this ruler and then drag it back and forth until 1 inch equals 1 inch. And then it would know exactly how many pixels per inch you had on your monitor to several decimal places in point of fact. And so that way, if you used points for font sizing, for example, they would show up as actual points. If you held up a typographic ruler, they would be however many points all you said they should be. 12 points would, in fact, be 12 points. Introduced text zoom. There had been text resize buttons in earlier versions of Internet Explorer, but text zoom was the first one that really let you zoom the text no matter what, even if the author had set their text size to 6. Its CSS1 support was excellent, not perfect. There still hasn't been a perfect CSS1 implementation, but it was quite excellent. Even today, it holds up fairly well. There are a few things that are a little weird, but it holds up quite well even today. The CSS2 support was, I feel comfortable saying decent. I wouldn't say great, especially in positioning where it has a number of bugs, many of which I had to deal with as recently as last year. But the things that it tried, it did well. Selectors, for example, it has very good CSS2 selector support. And, of course, full PNG support, like alpha channels and PNGs. It supported, when it was released, in 2000. And a whole bunch of other stuff, page placeholders, and just the list goes on for quite a while. But sort of in the CSS and web design space, these are the big ones. The only reason that IE6 for Windows has doctype switching is this right here, and the fact that the two teams actually did talk to each other. Contact was able to work with the Windows team and say, okay, now this is how you do it. Let's have these be consistent. Unfortunately, he couldn't get them to implement TextZoom, although he did try. A lot of the sloppy parser bugs in IE5 and IE5.5, things like allowing a space between a value and its unit, being allowed to leave off the octothorpe in front of a hexadecimal color value, getting the default font size wrong, all that stuff got taken out because of basically what happened here. And one of the things that the doctype switch also helped with was the width problem, the box model problem. Because in IE5 and IE5.5, width was defined to be this distance. Well, the CSS specification says it's really only here to here. In IE6 and standards mode, that's the right thing. IE6 and quirks mode, the thing that earlier versions of Internet Explorer did. That being a perfect illustration of why Todd was right, we needed that switch. Whatever that switch was, he proposed doctype because he's a really smart guy and sort of understood that would probably be the way to do it. But even if it had been some kind of meta element, whatever the switch was, it needed to be there. And so, and this is why, because otherwise, just imagine if IE6 had upgraded and done the correct width, and then every page that had ever been developed under IE5 and IE5.5 just broke, basically, in terms of layout, just went completely crazy. So, what's interesting, though, is that before IE6 came out, there needed to be a way, there were just enough browsers at that point. There was IE5 for the Mac, Netscape 6 was coming out, Opera had made very solid gains at that point in CSS support. And there needed to be some other kind of switch because everyone using Internet Explorer, and there were a few people doing that, was using IE5 and IE5.5. And they had the CSS box model wrong. They had width incorrectly set. There needed to be a way to say, okay, Internet Explorer for Windows gets these values for width, and browsers actually know what they're doing, get these values for width. That became the box model hack, which was devised by Contact Chellick, as a matter of fact, who, on writing on his site, said, hey, here's how we can do this. This is just an example. These are example values, but we have a div, and we want the actual content to be 300 pixels wide, but we want the overall box to be 400 pixels wide. So what we'll do is we'll exploit a parsing bug in Internet Explorer that says, okay, width 400 pixels, and then basically IE for Windows hits this and stops. It says, oh, the rule is done when it hits this point. It ignores this part. But browsers that don't have this parsing bug keep going, find the 300 pixels, which overrides the 400 pixels, and off they go. The only problem was Opera got the box model right, but had the same parsing bug, because Opera has had a very interesting history in being very standards compliant, but also doing a really good job of emulating Internet Explorer for Windows parsing engine. I don't know how they spent so much time reverse engineering that parsing engine, and I still am not sure why, but anyway. So then Tontek had to devise basically the child selector hack to say, well, Opera's going to see this value, or Opera's not going to see this value, it's going to see this value and get it wrong, so we need a be nice to Opera rule, which is exactly what he called it. So HTML child body, blah, 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 with 300 pixels, Opera can see that. Internet Explorer for Windows still won't see that because it doesn't understand child selectors, and there you go. Now, to me, this probably should have been called the voice family hack, because this is really where the hack is. It's, you know, taking advantage of parsing bug as applied to the voice family value. But because what Tontek was trying to do was give people a way to handle box model problems, that's why it ended up being called the box model hack. That pretty much lit the fuse for CSS hacks. This is a partial list of CSS hacks from the CSS Discuss wiki. I took a screenshot a few days ago, as a matter of fact. And hacks include, this is just some of them, and then here's a full section just for Mac browsers. The code bit OmniWeb hack. Hides files from OmniWeb. This is one of those things that you look at and you say to yourself, man, only that had never been necessary. But it was, of course. Because without these hacks, it would have been JavaScript browser sniffing. Uh-oh. Is that for me? There's either JavaScript browser sniffing and serving up different style sheets, or they're not really doing much styling at all. And I'm sure there would have been a number of people who would have been glad to not do any styling at all, except they couldn't really do otherwise. So, you know, hacks galore. Let's see, the import hack variation table. There's a whole table of variants on that import hack that I showed you originally, the linked import hack. Someone has a whole table just of variations on that. Using media queries, and so on. Tontek ended up devising a few of them. There was a bandpass filter and a midpass filter, which exploited other parsing bugs in order to do other fun stuff. But anyway, Tontek has since had time to regret that in a posting last year on his website, or maybe it was earlier this year. He talked about opening a Pandora's box. His hack actually had a distinguishing characteristic that many hacks didn't. His hack was valid CSS. You might not believe that. But if you look at it, it doesn't look like it's valid, but it actually does validate. Because this is referring to a voice family whose file name is, quote, escape quote, angle bracket quote. And so this hack will work fine until the day someone comes up with a voice family file called quote, angle, curly bracket quote, and then we'll be in trouble. But it was, you know, it actually was valid CSS. A lot, several of these anyway, were not. And I think that's one of the important distinctions to make. That if you're going to hack, at least do it in a way that's consistent with the specification that you're working or the language for it. So, around the same time, though, as people were hacking and slashing and basically browser detecting without JavaScript, there was sort of a backlash, which I admit I was part of, when I started publishing demos under what I called CSS Edge. Where basically I said, you know what, CSS is capable of a lot more than I think even we're aware of. And, you know, I'm sick of playing it safe. So I'm just going to push this out as far as I can. And I'm not going to worry about browser support. As long as it works in one browser, that's enough for me. And the only reason that I'm not going to publish demos that don't work in any browser is that then, you know, it would be one of those, can you see it? It's so beautiful in my mind. You know. So, you know, at least this way it was if you load it up in this browser, it'll do the right thing. Okay, so, you know, things like multi-level menus that require no JavaScript, which, you know, you exploit more advanced browsers' implementation of arbitrary element hover. You know, stuff like that was basically okay, it's not going to work in Internet Explorer for Windows, but I don't care. I'm really, really tired of stuff not doing stuff because it doesn't work in Internet Explorer for Windows. So we started doing that. Then in October 2002, this was a big turning point. Douglas Bowman, working for Wired, well, actually worked for Lycos, launched a redesign of Wired that used no tables whatsoever for layout. This is all positioning. Well, outside of the ad, I think the ad content still gave occasional tables, but the overall page layout is completely CSS positioning. And he did this in 2002. You know, doing it today, even doing it today would be at least, you know, a little bit of a challenge, not much. I've done it several times, but he did this, and suddenly people outside of the standards community, and inside the standards community, people have been saying for a while, hey, this could be done, but no major commercial organization had done it yet, and then Doug did it. And it was something that, you know, advocates could point to and say, hey, look, it can be done, and people outside that sort of community could say, oh my God, things are changing. The next turning point came about 6 months later, and that was the CSS Zen Guard, which I talked about 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, this was May of 2003, so just 3 years ago. Well, almost 3 years ago. Dave Shea launched this, and the reason this worked is he took a concept that several people had. Because I know I thought of something like this, not this exact, but something like it. The Web Standards Project, at one point, they had been talking about doing remixes, as they were thinking of them, of the Web Standards Project site. But nobody ever really got it together to do it until Dave did. But he not only put up the site and said, hey, you can style this any way you want and submit your styles, he actually did multiple sites. He did 5 style sheets to start with. They were dramatically different. I mean, this is one of the five. This is the default one. So there was this, and there was this. And it was exactly the same page, just had a different style sheet applied. So he'd done the same page 5 completely different ways, and then he said, okay, designers, have at it. Remix this page, you know, he didn't call it that. But, you know, go ahead and submit designs. He's up to almost 200 now, official designs. He's over 800 submitted designs. And they include designs like this one, which I love. I mean, the person who did this took that page, completely redid it like this. Or this one, which is fun, because I have a soft spot for late 19th, early 20th century stylings. This one, which just not only blows my head right out of the water, but is also one of the few valid uses of Comic Sans MS I've ever seen. And this one, which is just disturbing. So, you know, same page, different sign. This one, no less than the Wired redesign, was a major shift. This is when designers really started to, you know, web designers started to sit up and say, okay, wow. CSS sites aren't just boring, boxy sites. They could actually be beautiful. We could actually do what we do and not be restricted by the technology. Okay? Because one of the things about the Zen Garden was that unlike CSS Ed, and to be an official design, it had to work in all the major browsers of the day, effectively. If you submitted a Zen Garden design and it looked
like crap in Internet Explorer for Windows, it was not going to be an official design. It might get on the list, but it's not going to be official. So today, CSS is showing up in surprising places. This is a OS X chat client called Adium, which uses XHTML and CSS to style the message theme. Now, this is mine. I know, it's boring as hell. But I actually want it to be boring and like minimal because that gets the maximum amount of information on the screen, right? But I did this by defining my own XHTML template and writing my own CSS. You know, just because mine is boring, someone else's could be interesting. And there are a bunch of themes available, and really all it requires is understanding XHTML and CSS and having OS X, because they're just using the web core framework. They're just using the same engine that Safari does for this. So, and this came as a shock to me. I only found out about this because I downloaded Adium to try after having tried it previously and said, wow, this is kind of powerful. I like where this chat client is going, but I don't like any of the themes. And, well, there are all these installable themes, but I don't really like any of them either. None of them are as minimal as I want. So maybe I should dig in and find out how this is done. So I started digging into package content, and all I found was XHTML and CSS files, and it actually took me a couple of seconds to realize that, oh, that's how they're doing it. Wow. Okay. There's the dashboard in OS X. The way that these look is a combination of graphics and XHTML and CSS. Even the calendar. For whatever reason, they decided that they'd rather do that with CSS float than with tables. I actually tried to talk them out of that. When they emailed me, and I didn't know it was for the dashboard, but somebody emailed me at Apple and said, do you know of any ways to do like a monthly calendar without using table markup? And my answer was, well, yes, but why? They're like, no, just we really need to know. And I said, well, you can do it like this, but I really think you got to use a table. They're like, yeah, okay, thanks. And then it showed up in Encounter. It's like, you know what? You still should use a table, but whatever. Okay. Projection screen style sheets. This entire slideshow is a XHTML document with CSS and some JavaScript. The JavaScript drives the slideshow. The CSS makes it look how it looks. And now we have King Kong coming back. IE7, which once upon a time wasn't going to be, but now is in beta. Layout complete, so if you test it today, then that's pretty much the way it's going to be when it comes out in the second half of the year. And it has a whole bunch of new CSS stuff. It has fixed positioning. It has full alpha channels on PNGs. Thank you so much. It's only 2006. It has arbitrary element hover. It has advanced selectors. It has a whole bunch of improvements. It fixed a ton of bugs. So this is, IE7 is actually going to be a decent browser, like a worthwhile browser, something that is on par with Firefox and Safari and Opera in terms of standard support, well, at least visual standard support. I don't want to get into the DOM because that's not really my area of expertise, but. And CSS is still moving forward. We have Hokum Lee and Bert Boss just recently published an article on a list apart called, as you can see, Boom, Turning a Book with CSS, where they sort of created a book publishing microformat and some proposals for advancements to CSS that would help with publishing. Things like leader dots for tables of content. So you have the title and then a bunch of leader dots, page number. They proposed syntax to do that easily. And those are being considered by the working group. These are selectors from the CSS selectors draft, which is basically, so far as I can tell, CSS's primary bid to look more like Perl. But, you know, you can do really great stuff like tr nth child odd, which is select every other row. So you can do bumblebee alternate row striping without having to add classes all over the place, what you would have to do now. Whether you do it in the markup or via JavaScript. The empty pseudo class, which would select any paragraph element that doesn't have any actual content. And not, the not pseudo class, or pseudo element, or pseudo whatever it is, so you can say any child element of a div that's not a table, and then anything that's not either a link or an unvisited link, or I think this is any element that's not an unvisited link and not a visited link in the HTML namespace. I think that's it. This stuff still confuses me. So, anyway. And they're also looking at advanced layout. If you scrutinize the slide, basically what this, if browsers support this, what you do is create a layout grid and then shove various divs into spots in your layout grid. Again, looking like Perl, but there you have it. Or, I don't know, maybe that's more like Python. But anyway, so what's next? Interesting question. There's still stuff that CSS can do that we haven't figured out. Late last year, Alex Robinson published an article called The One True Layout. And while it wasn't necessarily the one true layout, it introduced three techniques that no one had ever thought of in 9 years of CSS1 being out. No one had ever thought of them before. We keep seeing CSS show up in new places, including in tools, Microsoft Expression Web Designer, Dreamweaver, Go Live, etc. And yes, advancement of CSS is very slow, but it is still going. So these are the things that I've learned. I'm getting a hairy eyeball, so I'm not going to read them. I'll just let you read them. And I'll hang out in the hall for questions if you have them. So thanks very much for the hour, and I hope you enjoy Nauticon.